The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to Literature on WRUU 107.5 FM. Here with me in the studio is P.T. Bridgeport.
Again?
Yes, right. I think we've just swapped chairs today.
Oh, that's exactly what we did.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, P.T., we have sometimes we look at literature of the past. Today, we actually have a book and an author that's pretty contemporary.
We do indeed, and what an author. This is somebody who, well, I've read two books by now, and I think I've probably read some of her pieces in the New Yorker without realizing it was her.
Right.
But it's Susan Orlean.
Yeah, and she is actually here in Savannah right now. You can actually hear her speak about her most recent book, The Library Book, this evening. So Friday evening, 7:30 p.m. at the Armstrong Center. She's giving a talk that is free and open to the public.
And that's a tremendous opportunity for all of us. I'll go right to the nub of it. I'm in the tank for the book. I love the book. It's so interesting how she put everything together. I'd really love to hear her comments on
it. Yeah, absolutely. And we'll give our listeners, if you don't know The Library Book, the majority of Susan Orlean's book is about the 1986 fire at the Los Angeles Public Library. One of the largest library fire in the United States, in the United States history. Very devastating fire. But most of her book also weaves in other stories. Now, I actually had an opportunity to speak with Susan yesterday, and we talked for about 20 minutes, and maybe, PT, we should share my interview with Susan with our listeners. And then when we come back, we can talk a little bit more about The Library Book. And
well, the other option would be for you to interview me, and that would be far less interesting. So let's go to what you talked to
Susan
about.
All right, well, PT, I'm going to interview you in the second half of our show.
But is that how it works?
Exactly.
Okay.
But we will still be talking about The Library Book.
Oh, okay.
So here is a little bit from Susan Orlean herself. Before you began this book, I know you mentioned early in The Library Book that you weren't looking for a new book project. What made you take this one on?
I definitely was not looking for a new book project. I felt like taking on the commitment of writing a book was just something I had decided not to do again. When this story kind of fell into my lap, it was so compelling, and it filled the two criteria that I respond to the most with stories. And that is, namely, it was a way of looking at a familiar world, that is, the world of libraries, in a whole new way, because I had never really stopped and considered what a library really is all about. But in addition, I felt like it was this dramatic story of the fire that somehow felt to me like it hadn't gotten the attention that it deserved. So that combination of the familiar and the unknown, coupled with the fact that I love libraries, made it really irresistible.
Right, and from a fellow lover of libraries and lover of books, one of the things your book did for me is it made me see libraries in a whole new light. Maybe we'll come back around to that. How did you learn about the 1986 fire at the Los Angeles Public Library? That's the major thread that sort of holds the whole book together.
Right. It was a complete accident, just a complete fluke. I had just moved to Los Angeles, and I was being given a tour of the downtown library, which I have to say, even though I'd visited LA many, many times in my life, I had never been to the downtown branch, the main branch of the library. As the person who was giving me the tour was leading me through the fiction department, he stopped for a moment, and he pulled a book off of the shelf, and he held it up and took a deep whiff of the book. And I had no idea what he was doing or why. So I kind of stood there, not sure what to do. And he said, you know, you can still smell the smoke in some of them.
Wow.
I didn't know what he meant. I said, did they used to let people smoke in the library? And he said, no, smoke from the fire.
Wow.
And I said, smoke from what fire? And he said, the big fire in 1986. The library was closed for 7 years.
Wow.
And I mean, my jaw dropped. And I wasn't living in L.A. at the time of the fire in 1986, but I still could not believe that I had never heard about this, which, as it turned out, was the largest library fire in American history.
Wow. In your book, the library book, you do talk about the extensive damage to the collection, to the building, to the community. I think you do a very good job of bringing to light for all of the rest of us how extensive this fire was and how devastating it was. Now, I know in writing your book, you also said, hey, look, maybe I need to see what it's like to burn a book. And you talk a little bit about that, about your experience. How difficult was that for you?
It was incredibly difficult. And that was so interesting to me because I knew logically that if I burned this book, I could go buy another one and replace it very easily. It wasn't a precious book. It wasn't a book in limited supply. And yet the emotional and psychological effect of burning a book was absolutely overwhelming. And in fact, for a while, I decided I wasn't going to do it. I had thought originally that it would be a good thing to do for the purposes in my book of describing what a book looked like when it burned. And also, I was curious. I thought, you know, it sounds like a horrible thing to do, but maybe it's not that terrible to burn a book. Well, it was much harder than I thought, and there was a point at which I just decided I couldn't do it. I felt so uncomfortable. There's a really deep connection between humans and books. There is a way that we feel that they are almost alive.
Right.
And this has been observed since books were first written. There is something sort of spiritual about the nature of a book that makes it feel like more than just an inanimate object.
Right. You write that they have souls even. That's how we sort of feel about them.
Yes, and from the beginning of time, even Milton, the poet Milton, wrote about how books seem to have the potential for human life. When you think about it, of course, a book, everything in a book is created out of our minds and our knowledge, and they are almost an accessory to what goes on inside a human mind.
Right.
And even though we now know we have books that are produced in the millions, they are not in many cases hard to replace, and yet we still have a kind of reverence for the book that makes it very hard, let alone burn one, throw one out.
Right, absolutely. I mean, many scholars have written that, you know, our life as lived doesn't have meaning until we turn it into narrative. And so, I mean, encapsulated in all of these books is the meaning of our lives.
Exactly. And I think that there is something wonderful about that, that this object, which is just paper and ink and glue, has the ability to feel like an extension of us, and that we have that kind of love and reverence for them.
Right.
It's also why burning books has been used as a tool of intimidation and repression, because people feel terrified and horrified by a government or an invading army burning their books.
Right. Absolutely. Now, your book, the library book, it's when I read it, it's almost a collection of in-depth articles or short stories, each chapter featuring sort of a different person and a different aspect of a library. And then, of course, you hold the whole book together by this thread of mystery about who was responsible for the fire and why. I'm curious, why did you decide to write your book this way? It's almost, you know, in-depth articles or a short story collection that's held together by a common theme?
The book felt like, in a way, a browse through a library.
Right.
it was so many individual stories, each one which seemed important and complete in itself. And rather than minimize one for the sake of having an overarching narrative, it felt really natural to me to tell each of these stories as if they were little volumes within a library.
That you're just pulling off the shelf.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's why I began each chapter with a list of other books.
Right.
Real books that exist in the library, to give the reader the sensation of browsing on a bookshelf and then landing on one book, which was the chapter that they would begin to read.
Right, like a wonderful accidental finding after you've been browsing in the library all day.
And that's, of course, what we love so much about libraries, is not only that you go in there and you find what you set out to find, but sometimes you find things you didn't even think you were looking for, and they are just as delightful and engaging
as what you were seeking. Absolutely. Do you have some favorite stories or favorite chapters? I know I picked out sort of my favorites, particular stories of people you interviewed or some of the history you dug into.
I loved the history of the early librarians.
I did too.
And I just was, I became fascinated by Charles Lummis, who was a truly eccentric genius who ran the library for 5 years at the turn of the century. And I could have lingered on his story forever. In
right.
fact, there was a point where I thought, you know, I should just do a book about Charles Lummis.
Right.
Those history chapters were really fascinating, really marvelously alive in a way that you don't always think of history as being. But to me, they felt, I think because if you go into the library, you're reading books that those librarians chose to include in the library. I mean, the library is very much this living legacy. It's been created by the people who've run it.
Right.
So I love doing those chapters. I also found it really challenging and wonderful to try to write about the fire itself.
Right.
And to give people a sense of the fury and power of this terrible fire.
Right, absolutely. Charles Lummis was one of my favorites as well in the book. Now, he was a bit of an eccentric character. He had actually displaced, there had been many years of female librarians even back in the day, right? But so Lummis replaces
right.
several of them. He's kind of what this wild eccentric character, what he walked from his home state to Los Angeles before he started the job.
Right. I mean, he was, from day one, a very unusual man, a person who never did things the simple way, the obvious way. He had been living in Cincinnati when he was hired by the LA Times. And rather than take a train across the country, which would have been typical at the time, he hiked across the country, which was not very typical. He was a terrible sexist, I have
yes.
to say, for all of his genius. And he really had some revolutionary and very significant attitudes about a lot of what interested him. unfortunately, he had an incredible blind spot when it came to issues of gender.
Right.
And he did displace a woman librarian who had been running the library for 5 years,
right,
with great acclaim.
Yeah, very successfully. Yeah.
Very successfully. And, you know, this was certainly a very progressive thing, since women didn't run much of anything at the turn of the century.
Right.
But Lummis also really democratized the library. He took it from being a place that really welcomed scholars and academics, and he broadened what the mission of the place was, which was he saw it as a place for anyone who wanted to better themselves.
Right.
And he really promoted it to people, workers and factory workers, railroad workers. That was not typical in that time.
Right. But that's how we think of the library today, right?
Yes, but at that time, in 1900, that wasn't the way libraries functioned. First of all, many of them were exclusively open to men.
Right.
No children.
No children.
No women.
That's right.
No children, which is shocking to us, since now I would say most people think of libraries as serving children first and foremost.
Right.
But kids were not allowed in the library, and they were really quite elitist. They were for educated people to do more scholarly work, and
right,
they were not seen as being something that was welcoming to everyone.
Right, the broader community, right. Now, you also interviewed a lot of current individuals, directors, and people who work in all aspects of a library. One of the things that surprised me, this was my own sort of unacknowledged bias, is that some of the library workers you interviewed weren't necessarily quote-unquote lovers of books. They said, hey, this is a really good job. Did that surprise you as well?
No, not really. I mean, I think that there is no librarian who doesn't care about books and feel committed to the mission of the library, but they're not all just book lovers.
Right.
I mean, it's a civil service job that is, I mean, if you're a librarian, you need to have a master's degree. It's a very specific profession. But to be a clerk in the library, which is not a skilled position, it's a good place to work.
Yeah.
People are nice. It's a civil service job that pays well. So it sort of caught me by surprise, and then I thought, oh, well, but that makes sense.
Right.
I mean, it's a job.
Exactly. Now, you've called libraries portals and places of passage, and particularly today, sleek ships. What do you think is the state of libraries today, or libraries of our future? I know you've attended and spoken at many library conferences as well. Where are we now? Where are we going?
I feel very encouraged about the future of libraries, and I think the big inflection point was the moment when the internet came into our lives in a huge way, and libraries suddenly were competing with this epic and almost insurmountable system for organizing knowledge that was almost seemed to make libraries obsolete.
Right.
And they're not. And very wisely, instead of kind of fighting against the internet or declaring themselves just repositories for books, libraries really embraced the internet and saw it as just another way for people to get information. Libraries anointed themselves and then were anointed by the public as being the community's access point to the internet.
Right.
Which certainly in the early days of broadband was an enormous value. Most people didn't have broadband at home. And not everybody has it now. So right. It still remains an important factor. But they've also just expanded the sense of how we learn and grow. They offer more and more programming, which is something that libraries are in a really good position to do. They're usually nice spaces that have room to hold classes and workshops, consultations, literacy programs. You know, they've begun to picture themselves not just as a place where books are, but where all knowledge can be found.
Right. And this coming...
I think it's a very encouraging future. And we're very lucky to have a whole generation of people running libraries around this country and around the world who really feel excited about what libraries will be. And that's a kind of wonderful thing.
I agree. Absolutely. Now, what about you? What are you working on now? Are you focusing on more of your journalistic and shorter pieces, or do you have another project that you're working on or that's in the wings?
Well, I'm doing a few things. I'm working on some stories for The New Yorker, and I'm toying around with the idea of doing another book, which is very funny since, of course, I had made this great declaration that I was never going to do another book.
And right.
Besides having done the library book, now I'm thinking, that was kind of fun. Maybe I'll do another one. So it's something that I'm toying with, and I'm hoping that I'll plunge in pretty soon.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul. This portion of WRUU-LP, Savannah Soundings programming, is brought to you by listeners and by the Savannah Jazz Festival, which brings jazz and blues to Forsyth Park and other locations around Savannah from September 22nd to the 28th. The Savannah Jazz Festival is presented by the Coastal Jazz Association with investment from the City of Savannah. Evening concerts followed by nightly jam sessions bring artists such as Dolette McDonald, The Huntertones, Big Sam's Funky Nation, Vanessa Rubin, and Annette Cohen to Savannah. For more information, go to savannahjazzfest.com.
Tonight on WRUU, tune in at 7 for Feel the Darkness, Underground Punk and Hardcore. At 8, Let's See Who My Friends Are interviews ordinary people sharing their stories. At 9, Soul Sensations features R&B through the decades. At 10, the Savannah Music Festival Live brings you music recorded at the Savannah Music Festival. And at 11, we bring you 2 hours of Friday night dance music. Our latest schedule is always at WRUU.org. Thanks for listening.
All of us here at WRUU want to thank you for 3 years of the best radio on the air in Savannah. We're having a party to salute you, our listeners, and those whose extraordinary time and talent got this radio station from dream to reality. Join us for our annual meeting and fun drive kickoff party on Friday, October 4th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Starland Yard, Savannah's coolest new event venue, a food truck park on DeSoto Avenue in Midtown. We'll have DJs, food, raffle drawings, and recognitions for our station's builders. We hope that will be you, because we are listener-supported community radio. Become a supporter today at WRUU.org or in person with many of your favorite hosts in attendance at our party on Friday, October 4th. There's more information at WRUU.org.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature here on WRUU 107.5 FM. So, PT, before the break, we had played my interview from yesterday with author Susan Orlean, who is here in Savannah. She's here as part of the Georgia International Conference on Information Literacy, and she is speaking tonight at a lecture that's open to the public. I was told 7:30 p.m., but on the website it says 7:15 p.m. at the Armstrong Center.
I think that the book is popular enough and she's well known enough that it might be a good idea to get there a little early anyway.
Exactly, right, exactly. So Susan Orlean speaking about her most recent book, The Library Book.
Yeah. She makes passing reference to swearing she'll never do another
That's
book.
That's right.
But she's already done 10 of them.
Wow.
In addition to her writing in short pieces and contributing to various different collections.
Right.
And if we had had more time with her, you know, sit around a coffee shop or whatever and just chat, I'd love to know more about her take on a writer's life.
Absolutely. I was one of the questions, you know, I always like to ask, especially our authors, you know, what advice would you give to all the aspiring writers out there, and what, you know, what is her process like? She squeezed us in as much time as she could, and we really
she was very generous, we thank
her for that. Now, PT, before we go and really kind of talk about the library book, you have read some of her other books.
Yes. There was one that's been turned into a movie. The book was called The Orchid Thief, but the movie was called Adaptation, I believe.
Okay.
It is a true story about a man who essentially goes into the swamps of South Florida and poaches orchids. It's really not about the man so much as it is how deeply people love orchids and the extent they will go to get them.
Right. That's similar to the library book, because even though she holds
the
whole narrative of the library book together with this thread of, you know, they think it was arson, you know, and she talks about the potential arsonist Harry Peake, but, you know, in the end, who knows if it, you know, if it really was arson. Similar story. She really is focusing on why people love libraries and why people love books so much. So just like in The Orchid Thief, same type of approach, maybe.
Right. One thing I think she does especially well is she weaves together three or four aspects of a story. It's something that we see a lot now in books, on television, in the movies, just about everywhere.
Right.
There's always a plot and several subplots, or sometimes you can't even figure out which one is the main plot.
That's right, right. And in the library book, you know, she interviews so many different people from so many different libraries. You know, the shipping and distribution section, you know, the front staff, the leaders, the, you name it. So you really get a nice insight into every aspect of a library, as well as going into that, to the history of libraries in general, but also the history of the Los Angeles Public Library, which was my favorite part.
Right. And one thing she did for me, kind of an odd byproduct, she goes also into depth about what libraries are doing now and where they were going.
Right.
And I have used libraries pretty extensively in the past, and I see new opportunities opening up for me because the libraries have access to so much more now through the internet and what have you.
Right.
So a library, while I have only sporadically use the library for reference, I think it might become a bigger part of my reference finding now.
No, absolutely. You know, between community libraries, and of course, I spend a lot of time in our university libraries. You know, we as academics couldn't survive without libraries. Our students couldn't survive without the library. And more than just, as you were saying, PT, and as Susan says all throughout her book, more than just, you know, places to go find knowledge and find information. They are spaces where you can gather and work on projects together. reference librarian save me every single time I need to write a paper.
She said it in the interview, they've become not a place of books, but a place of knowledge.
Yes, and a place of gathering.
Right. Right.
And we've talked on prior episodes about how community library is a place where you go to vote in my library, and one of the last elections, that's where I went.
Or right.
Where you go to maybe learn new skills.
There are all sorts of really neat, interesting things that libraries can and will do. One of the things I miss about the current library is, due to various different factors, they're not open as much as they were in the past.
Right.
And I think... especially if they had longer night hours, that would encourage even more of that.
Right. So along those same lines, PT, that reminds me of one of the stories that Susan Orlean tells in her book, The Library Book. And of course, this is many, many years ago, where the Los Angeles Public Library, I believe, had a service called the Hoot Owl Service, where you could call up late at night.
Yes.
And ask trivia, you know, basically trivia questions, or you're seeking some kind of answer to some kind of
right.
question you have. And there would be people on the other end to try to locate that answer for you. So, of course, I sit and I think about, you know, you're sitting in a bar or in a tavern with some friends playing trivia or getting into a debate about something, and you need a definitive answer, you could call the Hoot Owl Service.
Right. Of course, nowadays, and I think she says this in the book, you can look it up on Google. You don't have to call anybody.
That's
so,
right. Which is very confusing. Convenient, but kind of sad, because at least in the old days you could
yeah.
connect with someone.
And added a little luster to what they were trying to do.
Right, absolutely. Now, oh, go ahead, PT.
One of the other things I wanted to get into when we talk about, if we were able to talk to Susan Orlean about the writer's life, is the amazing spectrum of articles that she's done. In addition to Orchid Thievery and libraries, she's written extensively about travel. She's done collections of pieces from New Yorker. She's an animal lover.
Yes.
So she wrote an entire book about Rin
Tin
Tin.
That's right.
And another one called Animalish, which I presume is about... her love of animals. She's also written co-written a cookbook.
Okay.
With her dog, Cooper. It's called Throw Me a Bone. It's recipes for dogs. But of all her things, the thing I'm most interested in reading next by her is a book called Red Sox and Bluefish. She once worked in Boston, and they asked her to write something. She was writing something every week about somebody who is not New England being in New England.
Uh-huh.
And I shared that experience, so I'd be interested in seeing what she says.
So that's your list, huh?
Yeah, it's still a very interesting area
right.
to me.
I think you were telling me before our show that she also has a book about what people do in their evenings.
Yes, it's called Saturday Night, and as I understand it, well, it was written at least 20 years ago,
okay.
And apparently the new edition, she updates some of the people, how they've gone on from what they were doing on Saturday night 20 years ago.
Wow.
And that's another really interesting idea. Whatever else you may think of her, she comes up with really neat topics to talk about.
Yeah, she takes a different perspective.
She does, and at one point she writes about it very well and professional, and on the other hand, you can see that all this stuff is kind of meaningful to her.
Absolutely. Now, I was excited when she had said that she was thinking at one point in time about writing a whole book about Charles Lummis. I really was intrigued by a lot of the history that she wove into the library book. So the Los Angeles Public Library opened in 1873, and one of the harrowing details that Susan Orlean talks about in her book is the location in 1873 is an area where Native American children were basically sold in slave auctions.
Right. The early history of the West Coast is full of, well, it includes some fairly unpleasant stuff.
Very much so. And you know, I think in another venue, she might have expanded upon that a little bit more, right?
I think she could very easily. I suspect if she hasn't yet, she might. Right.
And then she also said in early days, there were fears about communicable disease. You know, this is a place of gathering of at least some members of the public way back when. And so there was also fears about communicable disease. She did mention in our interview about how originally libraries were for men, and eventually a ladies' room would open up, and you know, then the ladies could come to the library. But at first, there was no children, and eventually they started to allow children to come into the library. But people back then were very afraid; they didn't want the children to check out too many novels, or otherwise they would turn into fiction fiends, and that was problematic.
Right. Well,
or at least that was the thinking at the time.
Well, I wonder if that prediction wasn't true, and we'd be better off having gone another direction, but that's all right. No, of course libraries now are one of the primary users of the library, and that's how it should be. The library is multifaceted. It's used for serious research. It's used for children. It's used for people who just want reading material or DVDs or just a computer to work on.
A quiet place to think or write. We have a colleague who's done a lot of writing of one of her recent books in a library.
And then it does have gathering places for community members.
Right. I also love how Susan writes about not only all of these stories, but about her perspective on libraries. There's great reverence in how she phrases things. So let me give our listeners at least one quote from her. Maybe we'll read a couple more excerpts from the library book. So this is Susan Orlean, the library book. It wasn't that time stopped in the library. It was as if it were captured here, collected here, and in all libraries, and not only my time, my life, but all human time as well. In the library, time is dammed up, not just stopped, but saved. The library is a gathering pool of narratives and of the people who come to find them. It is where we can glimpse immortality. In the library, we can live forever.
That's, isn't that neat, huh?
Yeah, just a beautiful way. She sums up the essence of not only what we love about libraries, but what libraries give to us and do for us.
That's part of it. I was amazed that my personal experiences in libraries growing up were similar to hers. In we felt the same way about libraries. We used libraries the same way. She apparently had access to a bigger library than I did. We lived sort of in between two small towns, and when I'd get sick of what I found in one library, I'd go to the other library
and see what else you could find.
See what else I could find and switch back and forth. But I always got this tremendously positive feeling about it.
I think one of my best friends growing up, her mother was a librarian in our community library. And just like Susan Orlean, just like UPT, you know, I have memories of my mother taking me to that library and, you know, just letting me loose. And I could go browse through the shelves and see what I could find. And Susan Orlean, you know, she mentioned this in our interview, but she says this in the book. On a library bookshelf, thought progresses in a way that is logical, but also dumbfounding, mysterious, irresistible.
And so totally different from your normal life that it becomes attractive. It becomes almost a way of life, or I guess for librarians, it does become
a way
of
life. That's right. That's right. All right, PT, let me give our listeners a little bit more from the library book. This is later on in the book. This is a little bit of a longer passage. It seems simple to define what a library is. Namely, it is a storeroom of books. But the more time I spent at Central, the more I realized that a library is an intricate machine, a contraption of whirring gears. There were days when I came to the library and planted myself near the center of the main corridor and simply watched the whirl and throb of the place. Sometimes people ambled by with no apparent destination. Some people marched crisply, full of purpose. Many were alone, some were in pairs. Occasionally they traveled in a gaggle. People think that libraries are quiet, but they really aren't. They rumble with voices and footsteps and a whole orchestral range of book-related noises. The snap of covers clapping shut, the breathy whisk of pages fanning open, the distinctive thunk of one book being stacked on another, the grumble of book carts in the corridors. The shipping department is in the basement, invisible to the rest of the library. It is never quiet. The room is hard-walled and hard-floored. Sound ricochets around it like a cue ball. This particular morning, 8 men and 1 woman were at work standing side by side at a long counter piled high with books.
Yep.
Right. You know, when you think of...
If you've ever been in a large public library, especially a large city public library, that's pretty much it. You can hear all that and more. When I was in college, I spent a fair amount of time in the Library of Congress.
Oh, what a great library.
And at the time, if you were a graduate student, they let you into the stacks, which they would not do with the normal people. If you were not a graduate student, you had to fill out slips and then sit at your table and wait, which frequently was a couple of hours because somebody else had to go find those books for you, and most of the time they were all checked out anyway. But if you go into the stacks of a large library like that, you see some of the mechanisms, and those mechanisms are complicated, and they have to do things very precisely. You wouldn't think that, but they do. And it's kind of very interesting to watch. So that's another reason I love the book. The book takes you back into the machinery of the library.
Exactly. Think the places and processes that we as users of the library don't see and take for granted, I think.
Oh, absolutely. If people knew what it took to get them the information they want, who knows, they might even be more respectful for the information.
Right. But, I always laugh. It's like with housekeeping or editing that nobody notices unless you don't do it. And so a well-run library, people, all of us patrons are not going to be thinking about these things. But Susan Orlean gets us behind the scenes, as well as talking about books and libraries and the history. She gets us behind the scenes and the people who make libraries work well and work well for a very many large number of people.
Right. And so often libraries turn into, institutions that should really, other institutions should be handling. In any large library, there are going to be a number of people in a library who are there because they have no other place to go.
Right.
And that might be anything from people who are homeless to people who have processing problems to people who are just plain lost.
Right. Absolutely.
And libraries, you know, we talked about the mechanisms. One of the primary mechanisms is the librarian who's supposed to handle all of that.
Yes, right. The library has really expanded in its scope for what it does for each of us and for our communities.
Tremendously, and there's no reason it shouldn't. If you need a form particular to the city government, let's say, is there any reason you shouldn't be able to find it in the library?
That's right, yeah.
And especially now that we have the computerization of everything, and there's multiple ways people can use libraries.
So Susan alluded to this in our interview, although we didn't have enough time to really dig into it. Maybe she'll talk a little bit more about it tonight, but about the trauma and the destruction that this one fire in 1986 did. And when she was writing the, you know, the library book, she wanted to experience at least just a tiny sense of what it's like to experience a book burn. And so, PJ, if you'll let me read, it's about a passage from the library book. Susan Orlean is talking about, you know, how she thought about this and how she prepared to do this experiment. "Many times I have stood over a trash can holding a book with a torn cover and a broken binding, and I have hovered there, dangling the book, and finally I have let the trash can lid snap shut and I have walked away with the gosh darn book, a battered, dog-eared, wounded soldier that has been spared to live another day. The only thing that comes close to this feeling is what I experience when I try to throw out a plant, even if it is the baldest, most aphid-ridden, crooked-stemmed plant in the world. The sensation of dropping a living thing into the trash is what makes me queasy. To have that same feeling about a book might seem strange, but this is why I've come to believe that books have souls. Why else would I be so reluctant to throw one away? It doesn't matter that I know I'm throwing away a bound, printed block of paper that is easily reproduced. It doesn't feel like that. A book feels like a thing alive in this moment, and also alive on a continuum, from the moment the thoughts about it first percolated in the writer's mind to the moment it sprang off the printing press, a lifeline that continues as someone sits with it and marvels over it, and it continues on, time after time after time. Once words and thoughts are poured into them, books are no longer just paper and ink and glue. They take on a kind of human vitality. The poet Milton called this quality in books the potency of life. I wasn't sure I had it in me to be a killer."
And that's right. And incidentally, that brings up a problem that I have noticed. Now, I go through a lot of books. I generally buy them. There are a small percentage of them that I'm willing to keep around the house, because if I didn't, my entire house would be made of books.
Right, and there'd be no place to live.
And I feel the same way about throwing a book away, but lately there are fewer and fewer places to go with used books.
Right.
Of course, you can perhaps sell them to vendors who do that, but the library used to take them and sell them for a buck, and there was some bureaucracy about that. They can't do that anymore. And I'm just looking for places that will take books.
And we'll care for them and love them the way that we
exactly.
have.
Exactly.
Then pass them along to the next.
And consider them as the living beings that we and Susan Orlean thinks they are.
Right. And so I think that's why, PT, you and me and, you know, many others of our age range are sometimes moving more toward electronic books, whether we like it or not. Are you still resisting?
I think I can understand more out of a hard copy book than I can
me
out
too.
Of an electronic book,
me
quite
too.
Frankly.
And me too. That might be our age and the way that we learned how to read and the way that we approach gaining knowledge that's different today.
It might be. But I think it's a whole lot easier to cross-reference in a physical book than it is an electronic book. Okay. If I read something interesting back a few pages and I don't remember which page it was on, it's a lot easier for me to find with a physical book than it is with an electronic one.
I'm the exact same way. So I laugh in Susan's book, and she talks about, okay, how is she going to select which book she's going to burn in this little experiment? And of course, you know, she doesn't want to burn one that she loves. That doesn't
right.
seem right. She also says she doesn't want to burn one that she hates, because that seemed too aggressive, as if I were delighting in a sort of execution. So she said she could burn one of her own books, but she says, but the psychology of that was simply too much for me to sort through. And of course, in the end, she ended up settling on Fahrenheit 451.
Well,
so a very apt book for that experiment.
Yes,
right now, we only have about 5 minutes left. PT up at 1 o'clock, you can listen to Not Fade Away with Tim Hogenboom. So stick around for that. And again, if you'd like to hear Susan Orlean talk about the library book and libraries in general and the writing life, she will be at the Armstrong Center tonight, starting about 7:15. Right. So, Peachy, let me give our listeners maybe just a couple of last quotes from Susan Orlean's book.
Okay.
And then whatever time you and I have left, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
So she writes, "I was struck by how precious and foolish and brave that belief is, and how necessary and how full of hope it is to collect these books and manuscripts and preserve them. It declares that all these stories matter, and so does every effort to create something that connects us to one another and to our past and to what is still to come. This is why I wanted to write this book, to tell about a place I love that doesn't belong to me, but feels like it is mine, and how that feels marvelous and exceptional. All the things that are wrong in the world seem conquered by a library's simple, unbroken promise. Here I am. Please tell me your story. Here is my story. Please listen."
Great.
Yes, right. So we have about 3 minutes, PT. Any last thoughts about Susan Orlean's writing, the library book, libraries?
Yeah. Of her books, the ones that I've read about as much as, and as well as the ones I've read, the one that fascinates me most is one called Lazy Little Loafers.
Okay, great title.
And what it is the narrator of the story is taking on the persona of one of these people who doesn't particularly care for children and apparently goes off on some sort of tirade about how children get away with murder, and especially babies. And I've known a few of those people, and again, I marvel because she's gotten dead into something that's recognizable to me.
Right. And, you know, and I when I asked Susan about, you know, what's the next project she's working on, and she hinted that there is a next project, that there's something that has captured
her
attention. But she didn't give us any guesses or hints about what that project might be.
Well, again, we went over the sort of thing she's written about before, and there's such a wide spectrum. It could be almost anything. But the one thing it will be is something that's recognizable, and people will say, yeah, and pick that up.
Something from our everyday lives that we might have overlooked or not really given a second glance at,
right,
as we've gone through our lives.
Something we think about, and all of a sudden there's a book about it.
Right. All right. Well, I look forward to hearing her tonight, PT, and also seeing what she comes up with next, even though she swore she wasn't going to write another book.
Well, after 10, I might feel the same way.
I think just like with the love of libraries, love of writing, you can't keep away from it for too long. You might put it down for a little bit, but you can't stay away from it for too long.
Certainly not if you're doing it professionally.
Right, absolutely. Well, PT and I would really like to thank all of you for listening to Literature with us today. Stick around for Not Fade Away with Tim Hogenboom, and we will see you next week. Good day and good reading.
Bye, y'all.
The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.